this kind of noise. Now I seem to have a lot of noise in my transmission with the same configuration that I was using prior. Could this be the weather? Could this be going through the extra layers of water? Or is this just some magical property of the white stuff that I find lying all over my home?
That whole last transmission, John, you sounded beautiful. High fidelity audio, 95% audio, 5% noise, very little noise in the background. And I can hear the noise because I'm wearing earphones. Snow is an extremely desirable material when it comes to radio. I've done a couple of years worth of work at the Rome Air Development Center near Utica, New York. What makes their center so magic is they've got two mountains a couple of miles apart. They put the test system on one mountain, and they put the unit under test, a full-size aircraft, on the other mountain on top of the pedestal and rotate it back and forth. Well, they get the highest performance out of their world's best outdoor antenna range. Arguably, that's the best outdoor antenna range the Air Force owns, the Rome Air Development Center near Utica, New York. They get the highest performance when there is a foot and a half of snow on the ground on a minus 20 degree day. They get the least amount of undesirable ground reflection. They get the best possible signal strength. They get the cleanest signals with a foot and a half of snow on a minus 20 degree day. Let me drop. Under normal circumstances, water is the lossiest material in the world when it comes to radio. You can use a pot of water as a dummy load if you've got the right way of coupling into it. And you couple your RF energy into it, and all of that RF energy hitting the water gets turned into heat real fast. And the water can absorb the heat very nicely. Water is a very lossy material. A couple of drops of water inside of your type N connector on 432 can easily give you 10 or 15 dB of extra loss. A couple of drops of water inside a type N connector can give you 10 or 15 dB of loss. If it's in liquid form, you take a cold day with a couple of drops of water in your type N connector are now frozen and it's ice, and essentially all of that loss disappears. When you take water as a liquid material and freeze it so that it becomes a crystalline solid material, an entirely different material. Water has a loss tangent of 81. The bigger the number, the higher the loss. Water has a loss tangent of 81. Ice has a loss tangent of something like 3. In other words, a very small fraction of the RF energy hitting ice gets turned into heat. You can prove this to yourself very nicely. Let me drop. Put a glass of water, an eight ounce glass of water in your microwave oven alongside of an ice cube that's sitting on a foam pad. Run the microwave oven full blast. In my case, it's at 700 watts. Do it for 60 seconds. At the end of the 60 seconds, the water in the glass is almost ready to boil. The ice cube has a little bit of frost on its surface because some of the vapor coming off of the glass of water deposited itself on the ice cube. Ice does not absorb radio energy. It's almost transparent to it. Water has a dielectric constant of 81. Ice has got a dielectric constant, I think it's 3. That's a dielectric constant. I'm confusing that with loss tangent. Loss tangent's a much, much lower number. So when you get snow on your microwave dish, to your eye, it looks terrible, and people worry about putting a heater in there to get rid of the snow. If you ignore the snow on your microwave dish, the dish will keep right on working like a charm. When the snow starts melting and there's water on the dish, and if it's gathered in the right position, yes, that'll give you some extra degradation in performance. So the snow that's over your house is very radio transparent, very low in loss tangent, very low in dielectric constant. It's just a little bit more dense than air radio-wise. So the snow is not... Now, the weight of the snow is maybe doing some funny things, and maybe the snow is melting in certain places, and water is dripping into your cable and doing some funny things, but the snow is a beautiful material radio-wise. Ain't that opposite of common sense, John? Who would ever believe that? And you sound beautiful tonight. KD2IXP, K2LIW in the TechNet.
impossible for me to do. And people could, who would normally not have any trouble hearing me, were having a great deal of difficulty hearing me. And I was wondering, you know, if there was some cause or effect by the weather.
Yeah, your second half of your question is damn interesting, John. About 15 or 20 years ago, in my very enthusiastic days, I'm on the top of my tower in February fixing a particular antenna. And the mast of my 432 Yagi was alongside of my head. The mast went up another 5 feet, and the Yagi was on the top of that mast. It started snowing in February while I'm up there. And it was one of these kinds of snow, great big wide flakes of snow is coming down. And I know that I'm not going to be spending very much time up there because the rungs of the tower are going to start getting slippery. But I noticed that the flakes of snow were slapping me in the back of the head. And I said, gee, that doesn't make any sense. I also heard this sizzling sound. I looked up at the tips of the Yagi and I saw a purple glow. This was around 4 o'clock in the afternoon. It was starting to get dusk. In other words, it wasn't a bright sunny day. The snow was falling at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and all the tips of the Yagi had these purple glow, corona discharge is taking place from all of the sharp points. When snow is falling under certain weather conditions, let me drop this. Snow creates a hell of a lot of electrostatic energy in the air. Under certain weather conditions, particularly the people near Ontario, Canada, when I was up there once, they get an awful lot of snow lightning, snow thunder, because the snow falling creates this electrostatic charge buildup, and eventually you get lightning and thunder. Well, the top of my tower was getting charged by the snow falling, and my hair was standing on end, and the snowflakes were starting to slap me in the back of the head, and I'm watching the corona discharge from the elements of my antenna. When I came back down to the shack and listened to my buddy on 432, I'm hearing a whole bunch of sizzling sounds, a whole lot of noise. I mean, to get noise, to get electromagnetic interference noise, to get EMI, that's not the right word I'm looking for, to get QRNAMC on 80 meters is easy. On 432, except for certain kinds of fluorescent lighting, is rare. Well, Mother Nature's snowstorms can make some pretty loud noise on 2 meters and 432. Each of those station master antennas on top of those buildings for each of those repeaters on a snowy day, if you had a high resolution camera and a telescope aimed at the tip of that antenna, I'll bet you one third of the time when it's snowing, you would see purple corona discharge taking place from the tip of that antenna. And that corona discharge is a very noisy radio signal, random noise radio signal. So that's what I think you're experiencing. Almost all the repeaters that were being exposed to that snow, the antennas themselves were experiencing a corona discharge, a voltage buildup, electrostatic voltage buildup, just something that goes on with the snow itself, which is not too different from what happens in a rainstorm. The droplets of the aerosols in the air being sucked up by convection into the cloud, build up all kinds of high voltages in the cloud, and eventually we get a discharge that you and I call lightning. So precipitation static is a very specific word. So rain can do it, but snow can very easily do it, where you'll get a corona discharge from the tips of all of those repeater antennas. And when you're transmitting and receiving from the exact same antenna, and you're getting this corona discharge, boy, can that descent your receiver. That's what I think you're experiencing, John. KD2IXP, I've seen it. K2IZW in the Tech Man.
Where's it located, Dick? He's only making it into the plane view.
John, Eric is asking your QTH, and go on with your comment, John.
I'm in Jericho, and I'm only using 5 watts transmitting 5 watts on an HT. What town is he in?
He's in the town of Jericho, 5 watts out of an HT, Eric, go ahead.
So, he's not using an antenna of any form?
He's using an HT. You're hearing 5 watts. thoughts out of an HT, Eric. Go ahead, Eric.
Alright, that explains why he's so weak. Doesn't make it into the hospital either, but okay. I just thought I'd ask.
Yeah, we're not getting precipitation static right now. The snow has stopped, and you sound good to John. It's not a super strong signal, but for the distance you are from the repeater and a handy talkie, you sound exactly the way you're supposed to sound. The next step up, of course, is to use a base station rig with a little bit more power. But even with that handy talkie, if you made yourself a coat hanger antenna with an SO239 connector, and you hung it at some higher altitude in your QTH, and ran a piece of RG58 cable from it down to the handy talkie, that could make you 20 decibels stronger. Your 5 watts would sound like 500 watts if you did that. KD2IXP, that would cost you $5. K2LAW in the TechNet. You got it, John.
I'll have to take that up with my finance committee, but thank you very much for addressing my issue. Thank you for your time. Eric, thank you for your input. And gentlemen, as always, it's a pleasure. And 7-3, take care. KD2IXP.
Now, was there anyone else that tried to sign in tonight to the TechNet with a question or a comment that we missed, or you just joined us? And maybe you want to give us some information about what was the snow like in your neighborhood.
NY2H.
Go right ahead, Lou. By the way, how much snow did you get out there, Lou? I got around 24 inches.
Well, I haven't measured it, but it's probably about the same here in Port Jeff Station. Anyway, I wanted to talk a little bit tonight about the WOW signal.
Go right ahead, Lou. And by that you mean the Big Ear antenna at Ohio Wesleyan University in Miamisburg, Ohio. I have been there. I visited them partly because their low noise 1420 megacycle front end was a parametric amplifier designed by Airborne Instruments Laboratory. And I was working for AIL at that time. Beautiful looking antenna, which no longer exists. And that WOW signal that they saw, it was potent, and it had just the right double characteristic, which maybe you're going to discuss it with us. Go ahead, Lou, K2LAW.
So there was a recent article, and I guess Jerry Hemmon was the fellow who wrote down the word WOW. There was a recent article in New Scientist magazine where a professor of astronomy, Antonio Paris, at St. Petersburg College in Florida, came up with a theory about the origin of those signals. And his theory was that comets, there were two comets that were very close to the sun, such that they were emitting lots of hydrogen, millions of kilometer cloud of gas behind them containing hydrogen. And his contention is that it might have been the hydrogen emitting at 21 centimeters. I don't quite understand why a gas itself would emit energy like that, but maybe you can tell me. Of course, some people are skeptical about it, but they did discover later on, after the signal was heard, there are two comets that were in the area at the time that have since been discovered. Let me let it drop. And one is 266P Christensen, and it's going to return in next January. And the other is P2008Y2 Gibbs, and that's going to return in 2018. So they're going to test this theory out and see if these are indeed emitting the energy. People are skeptical. James Bauer of JPL Pasadena said that if that were the case, we should see more of the phenomenon, and we don't. Also, the comets would have had to have been traveling fast enough so that the next day, Big Ear would not have heard them. They would have been out of the range. Now, it was a fixed field, antenna, as far as I know. So, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, there's a couple of errors here, Paul. I mean, Lou. The next day is not the right day, and two signals is not the right number of signals. When you read John Krause's book called The Big Ear, in which he describes that antenna is a parabolic reflector, 150 feet wide, I think it's roughly 30 feet high, and it's in front of, parallel to the ground, 30 feet wide, 30 feet high, 150 feet wide, and it's laying on top of a sheet of aluminum. So there's a great big concrete pad with aluminum spread across it, which is the bottom half of that parabolic surface. So your eye sees a 30-foot high parabolic reflector. By way of the ground plane reflection of the aluminum, that reflector is really 60 feet high, 150 feet wide. In order to resolve the ambiguity of signals in space, John designed the antenna in such a way it doesn't have a single feed horn. It's got a pair of feed horns side by side. Let me drop. Two feed horns side by side. One's just a tiny bit left of the perfect focal point on the parabolic surface. The other one's just a little bit to the right. So one's a little bit left of focal point, and one's a little bit right. And the amount of gain you lose because it's a little bit off center is 0.01 dB. Don't worry about it. The reason he set up the two horns is he knows that when you're making radio astronomy measurements, you're measuring not a signal, you're measuring noise with a very accurate kind of receiver called a radiometer. Okay? A radiometer, the good news is it's capable of measuring very small amounts of energy very accurately. The bad news is because it is not identifying the signal, so to speak. You're not listening to call letters. You're not listening to a characteristic speech. In order to make sure that what you heard is real and not some kind of an artifact, he set up two feed horns side by side. The antenna is fixed in location, due south at some particular elevation angle, and he can tune the elevation angle. There is a reflector in front of that parabolic reflector, which is tunable, so he can go everything from out to the horizon to zenith straight up. I think he'd go to all of those particular angles, yes. Everything from the horizon to straight up and maybe a little bit beyond straight up. Always looking due south. So he sets the elevation number by setting the tilt of that flat plate that does the bounce. Then as the Earth rotates 15 degrees per hour, that signal coming out of that dish, which is probably around 1 degree or a half a degree beamwidth. I could calculate it. 1420 megacycles, 150 foot dish. I'm not sure the exact number. Maybe it's 0.2 degree of beamwidth. That 0.2 degree of beam, that if you could see the beam in three-dimensional space, looks like a vertical beaver tail. Let me drop. This vertical beaver tail in space, which is probably 0.2 degree wide and maybe 0.5 degree high. You know, it's a little bit higher than it is wide. That beaver tail sweeps across space at that particular set elevation angle for that day. It sweeps across space at 15 degrees per hour as the Earth rotates. He then looks at the recording of the two separate horns, and as the signal comes into the first horn, it gives you a peak of signal. Then it goes down out of the beamwidth of that horn, and a given number of minutes later, I forget the number of minutes, I think it's like 20 minutes, something like 20 minutes later, the second horn comes into focus as the Earth is rotating 15 degrees per hour, and now the second signal comes into the second horn, the exact same signal. You don't need two signals. One single signal in space, if it's real, will sweep through the two horns with an exact amount of timing between those horns, because you know the difference in the peak of beam, the boresight setting of those two horns. One single signal sweeping across those two horns, and once you see the second signal at the exact right time and the exact same amplitude as the first signal, you say, aha, that is that's an extraterrestrial source, and it's real. The wow signal fit that requirement. Let me drop. So that antenna is designed to resolve the ambiguity of one single signal at a time. The fact that it's got two horns is the reason why you get a double response, and it's a predictable double response. You don't need two signals. On top of that, this machine is cranking away, filling up a piece of computer track-to-feed taper, paper with the signal strength amplitudes being represented as an alphanumeric number on that table, on that paper. So at that particular time, a set of alphanumeric numbers indicate signal strength. When he looked at that signal strength on that piece of paper 1 week later, he says, wow, look how strong that is. And on that piece of paper, he wrote down the word WOW. And if you look at the piece of paper upside down, it looks like MOM, mom. So people sometimes call it the mom signal, but it's really the wow signal. He looked at it a week later. He realized something real potent took place, and they spent quite a number of weeks and months going back to that exact location, looking for that signal, and did not find it. So one single signal sensed a week later with exactly the right characteristic as it swept across those two horns in front of that parabolic surface. NY2H, K2RIW, go ahead, Lou.
K2RIW, NY2H. All righty, I'm looking at the piece of paper now, and it's 6EQUJ5. And he's got a big red circle around it, and he's got wow with an exclamation point. So there you go. It was facing at the constellation Sagittarius at the time. So anyway, they'll be able to debunk it or not, I guess within the next couple of years, if they set up and look at these comets and see if they get the same signature. But I guess what you're telling me is by radiometry, it's sensitive enough to pick up emissions from gas. So I suppose that's the deal. But most people are skeptical right now. As I said, the guy from JPL, a couple other people. So I guess the alien theory is still possible. But it'd be interesting to see what they find. They can put it to rest or not. But most people feel that you're just not going to get that amount of energy in this scenario. Back to you.
A radio telescope is looking at radio emissions in space of a non-coherent nature. Sometimes they sense with polarimetry whether or not the signal is horizontal, vertical, clockwise, counterclockwise, and so on. That gives you some interesting information as far as local magnetic fields are concerned with the so-called Zeeman effect. But the majority of what they're measuring is hot gas. When you look at solar noise, you're looking at the hot gas of the sun, those molecules or atoms of the sun running at a very high temperature. Those electrons are excited to a higher orbital level around that nucleus. As they drop back down, they emit a very characteristic frequency. 1420 megacycles is a very characteristic frequency. When an excited electron around a hydrogen atom jumps back down to the base state, it emits a signal of 1420 megacycles. So any gas that's above absolute zero, 0 degrees Kelvin, is emitting signal. I, for one, set up a radiometer receiver connected to that 12-foot parabolic dish antenna that I was setting up to listen to the Apollo 15 astronauts. Let me drop. And I was measuring the characteristics of the dish, its beam width and its gain and whatever. Because the dish is 12 foot in diameter and I'm feeding it, I'm using it at 2287.5 megahertz, S-band. That's the command service module downlink frequency. And to test a 12-foot dish at that frequency requires an antenna range 700 feet long. AIL owned 5 different anechoic chambers, but the biggest one was only 100 feet. So I had to use the universe. I used sun noise. So by aiming the dish at the sun, using the sun as a radiometry noise source transmitter, and sweeping the antenna back and forth across the sun, I could measure the antenna pattern and the antenna gain. And with that, I found out that we had an error in the dish where the surface needed greater surface accuracy improvement. But when I stood on a wooden chair in front of that dish, and I reach up to grab the feed horn in order to adjust the focal length, I'm recognizing the fact that the radiometer receiver was pegged. It's being pegged by the 2287 megacycle signals coming off my body because I'm at 320 degrees Kelvin, so to speak, and the sky, that the dish was aimed at the sky 30 degrees above the horizon. It's looking at clear blue sky, and the sky is 20 degrees Kelvin. I'm 320 degrees Kelvin. Radio-wise, I'm hot. My body is emitting S-band signals because I am hotter than the cold sky. The molecules of my body are being moved around that way, emitting broadband radio noise, and it was pegging the receiver, the radiometer receiver. It was that sensitive, and as far as that receiver system is concerned, I was a hot radio source, if you know what I mean, way outside of the focal length, but my body was taking up a significant percentage of the area of that dish that was from you previously looking at cold.
Repeater, timeout.
That dish previously was looking at cold blue sky, and when I stood on that wooden chair in front of it, I'm a hot object in front of that dish. I soon realized that there's a whole art and science being revealed there. You take an antenna like that and you aim it through the wall of a building, say for instance a sheetrock wall. If it's a human being on the other side of that sheetrock wall, you will see the thermal energy coming off that human being into that receiver. So everything in space that's above absolute zero temperature is emitting a radio signal, a predictable amount of radio signal. That's what radio astronomy measures. NY2H, K2LIW, go ahead, Lou.
K2LIW.
Okay, Eric, it's recognized. I should not be surprised. I had a C-band satellite receiver back in the day. And I guess during the fall, or occasionally maybe twice a year, for about a week each time, the bore site would go, the sun would be right behind the satellite, and the energy of the sun would swamp us out for about 20 minutes or so. So I do recall that. I'll turn it back to you, Dick, and you can turn it over to Eric. And by the way, I do have, if anyone wants to go in the chat room, I have a couple links to the article that I was referring to, back to that NY2H.
You got it, Eric.
Joe, I guess Lou is a mind reader. I was going to say that most broadcast operations are radio, television. A couple times a year, we get this thing called sun outages, where the sun signal is actually stronger than what comes out of the satellite. It occurs for, Lou said about 20 minutes. Everybody knows about it long before it actually happens. It's calculated as a chart that you can look at. But it happens at different times of the day, at different periods of the year. So, and of course, it all depends upon which satellite you're looking at, because that only occurs with that specific satellite, where the satellite next door is fine. So, RWK2J.
Yeah, the sun as a radio emitter was predicted for a long time, starting off at around 1900. And multiple attempts were made between 1900 and 1945 to measure sun noise, and they were all unsuccessful. At microwave frequencies, the receivers of that day all had a mixer diode front end and probably a 14 dB noise figure, and they weren't sensitive enough, and there wasn't the right kind of a radiometer receiver in the back end listening to that noise. The very first extraterrestrial noise that was ever measured on planet Earth that we know about was done by Carl Jansky, 1932. He's working for Bell Labs, and their overseas radio circuits are from time to time hearing an awful lot of noise. And somebody started asking the question, hey, Carl, where the hell is that noise coming from? Let me drop. So Carl builds this great big Sturber curtain antenna, where the exact antenna is sitting at the National Radio Astronomy Observatory in Green Bank, West Virginia, as a national resource artifact. This antenna was, I'm guessing, around 20 feet wide. It's a Sturber curtain is a certain way of bending wire and supporting it in space. So you get this antenna pattern, and he was using it at something like 17 megacycles. So I'm not sure of the exact number. If I had to make a guess, I'd say his antenna had about a 5-degree beam width at 17 megacycles. And it's mounted on this chassis that sits on four automobile wheels that were popular in 1932, so he could rotate this thing. So he's got a sensitive receiver by 1932 standards at 17 megacycles, and he rotates this antenna, and he finds a source of noise. The noise peaks up in a particular direction. And so from day to day, he's measuring that noise and say, what the hell could that be? And he was a smart enough scientist to realize that the exact angle of arrival was changing by 1 degree every day. He said, what the hell is doing that? How can there be a source of noise out there in my ionosphere, in my atmosphere, where the source of noise moves 1 degree every day? Suddenly realized it wasn't coming from Earth. As the Earth goes around the Sun, the whole universe, as far as you're concerned, moves by 1 degree every day. And so he was looking at the center of our galaxy. The center of our galaxy, we now know, has got a couple of black holes and a whole lot of other violent things going on there. Let me drop. So he was measuring the noise from the center of our galaxy, and he realized that it's an extraterrestrial source, and by the way it shifted from day to day, he figured out what it was. Then he dropped the project. He made the measurement, he got the answer they were looking for, and he went on to something else. The standard unit for radio astronomy is called the Jansky. I think it's 10 to the minus 32 watts per square meter per cycle per second. I think it's the unit. So the standard unit is the Jansky. And was he a radio astronomer?
Yeah.
Not really. Grote Reber, a ham radio operator in Wheaton, Illinois, a W-9, built himself a 31-foot diameter parabolic dish in roughly 1939 is when he started doing it. He read the Carl Jansky article and got turned on by it. And he was the first real radio astronomer, a ham radio operator. The very first time that solar noise was measured was in the middle of World War II, roughly 1945. Let me drop. An armed forces radar started seeing great big chunks of noise in 1945. And they thought it was German jamming. They suddenly realized it was the sun. The sun was making one hell of an outburst of some kind. I can't think of the three-letter abbreviation for when it kicks off a whole lot of energy. So the sun was making an outburst, and that radar saw it. And that was kept secret for a while until it...
They call it a CME.
Coronal mass explosion. There it is, CME. So the sun was doing a CME, a really violent one in 1945, which, by the way, was the peak of the sunspot cycle around that period. So the first time the radio astronomy noise of the sun was measured is during World War II with a radar in 1945. But lots of people were predicting it before that. They just didn't have a sensitive enough receiver. A modern-day receiver doing radio astronomy. Let me drop it. By modern-day standards, the sun is an extremely loud source of radio noise, if you got the right kind of equipment. So, I think the writer of that article, Lou, is misunderstanding the design of the dish. He hasn't read the book, The Big Year, by John Krause. He hasn't visited the installation. He doesn't realize you don't need two sources. You only need one source, because it's got a double horn, and the double horn was there to make sure you're resolving ambiguity. In fact, I think in order to get greater sensitivity out of the system, they would take the noise out of the first horn and subtract it from the noise out of the second horn. So only a signal that appears in one horn at a time will show up on their strip chart recording. That gets rid of the problem of broadband noise. If somebody turns on a fluorescent light a mile away, it's going to give you an equal amount of noise in both horns, so to speak, even though it's way out of focus, and it gets subtracted out. So it's a dual channel interferometer radio astronomy subtraction receiver, I think is what it is. Any other comments on this one, Lou? So as you can see, the guys writing this article are looking for a dual source. Everything in the world that's hot to a radio telescope is going to give you a signal. Everything that's above absolute zero. If you've got a high enough gain antenna, a sensitive receiver, low enough noise figure front end, and a sensitive enough radiometer, you're going to see the noise out of any object that's above absolute zero in temperature. NY2H, K2RIW.
very good. Well, it's kind of like noise-canceling headphones there. In any event, I'm not quite sure if the author was addressing the dual signal or anything like that, so I didn't get that out of the article, but it'd be interesting to see if they run the experiments, what they come up with. And we shall see. So there you go. So I'm good with that. And K2RWNY2H.
Okay, at this time we go over to the mailbag. KC2WCB. I was hearing some pretty big reports of certain portions of Staten Island got numbers like 28 inches of snow. And one of those places that got a lot of snow is the town of Elting in Staten Island. And you live on a street called Elting, but maybe you're not in that town. I wonder how much snow you got, John. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Good evening, Dick. Everyone is
there. Yeah, we got a little snow. Basically, it was more like 8 or 10 inches. Drifts were immense. That would be Eltingville, and got hit harder. Problem. I had to shovel a drift. It was a berm. Basic sidewalk was clear, right down to the sidewalk, but where I had to walk between my sidewalk to my lab, it was 7 foot drift, about 10 feet wide, and that maximum collection of snow right against the door of my shack. So I spent it through a gate tunneling in, and my driveway is covered pretty deep. I won't do the wind. Snow was basically in. Not too bad, Ryan.
HRO. HRO recognized, but first I got to get back to John. John? You're either talking into the wrong microphone, or you're talking into the back of that microphone. I'm hearing your voice by way of the reflections off the walls of the room that you're in. I'm not hearing your voice directly by that microphone. And you're about 8 dB weaker than normal. KC2WGB, K2RIW, go ahead, John.
Oh, you're absolutely right, Dick. It's much more pleasant to talk into the correct microphone. I'm having trouble with the Pro 40. I'm on a hand mic, and I was pressing the hand mic button and talking into the Pro 40. Go ahead, pick up the other station.
Huge improvement. Oh, boy. Now you're back to normal. John, HRO, go right ahead.
Two things wanted to say. The official reading at Central Park was 26.8 inches. For the storm, and Kennedy Airport was 30 and a half inches, so, you know, not including drifts or anything, and, so it was a pretty good storm, but, you know, we can handle it, not that bad. It makes it quiet and clean for a while, so that's what I like. And I was going to mention something about the noise. You were talking about how snow and rain, how it affects noise on the antennas and stuff. It will also affect how well a VHF signal is transmitted, you know, picked up and received. I noticed that changes with the weather. They used to say, oh, VHF isn't affected by the weather. That's not true. It is. So that's that. And the other thing is that you talked about, I had mentioned earlier in the net about the 600 ohm line. I want to use it for a all band dipole, basically. An all band, you know, 80 through 10 meter dipole. I'm trying to replicate one that is sold by a company called TrueLateline.com. And that's why I wanted to use the 18 gauge wire, since I have miles of it. And I wanted to know the right spacing to get approximately 600 ohms. I think it should be a little less than 4 inches the way I figure it, but maybe 3.5 inches, I don't know. But anyway, it's going to work on all bands, and I assume it will, because I understand that if you put it through an antenna coupler, between the line and the antenna was the
repeater timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Making it and measuring it like Hal said, that would be impossible for me to do. But if someone said it, if you have to make it so many inches apart, I know what to do with the spacers and how to make them. So back to control. Over.
Yeah, by way of internet, there's a lot of articles on open wireline and various ways of building it. And as I said before, 600 ohms, there's nothing magic about that number. People have built open wireline, I'll bet you as high as 1,000, and I know they built it as low as 50. Wires very close together. In fact, I've even done that on one occasion. You take a pair of wires that you normally use for hookup wiring and twist them together, and it makes a fairly nice transmission line, twin lead transmission line of around 50 or 70 ohms. Central Park, I think, got 26.8 inches during this storm. The all-time high record for Central Park in New York City is 28.9. We came within 1/10 of an inch of breaking the all-time record for snowfall in Central Park in all of the years of weather-keeping records. I am guessing Central Park was created somewhere around 1900, so I guess you can say we've been keeping records since the time that Central Park was created. Let me drop. Yeah, I got something in the vicinity of 24 inches, 23 inches. So my driveway is 90 feet long and roughly 20 feet wide. So thank goodness my snowblower was working pretty well. And it helped me move close to 4,000 cubic feet of snow. Lots and lots of snow. Before I had a snowblower, in the old days we used to do that manually with a snow shovel. And of course that's back-breaking work. Only took a very small fraction of a gallon of gasoline to move all that snow and blow it away, so to speak. What was the other subject we had just mentioned? That'll do for now. So, John, what kind of mailbag response have we gotten? And if I know you, you're waiting for the snow to melt out of your driveway. You're not even going to bother shoveling it or snow blowing it. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
TechWS2N, about the snowblower.
Go ahead, Paul. Tell us about snowblower. Did you do a lot of snow? Well, out there in Ronkonkoma, how much snow did you get and how much snow blowing have you done, Paul? Go ahead.
Oh, okay, yeah. Well, I slipped. I always get the report by the airport. I'm close to the airport. So they got, what was it, 25.9, so let's call it 26 inches. I was just curious about the horsepower on your blower. Yeah, I moved a lot of snow as well. Back to you.
The actual manufacturer of my snowblower is Ahrens. It's an Ahrens 24-inch wide snowblower, two-stage snowblower. I don't know the size of the engine. I do know that Bernie, K2YO, he and I own similar snowblowers, and he could tell me the exact horsepower. If I had to make a guess, it's 5 horses, but I don't know for sure. I'm guessing the tank holds at least a pint of gasoline. I don't think it holds as much as a quart. And less than half a tank was required to blow away all that snow. Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, most people here have the gas ones. The last, I guess, 4 or 5 years, I've had an electric one, and it works quite well. Very good, Dick. You know, they've come a long way with the electric ones, so. What's nice about it, it's light, and it's easy to store. It doesn't take up much room. Back to you, Dick.
Now, in my case, the chute on the front end of the snowblower is 24 inches wide, 20 inches high. And throughout most of my driveway, the snow is around 23 inches high. So roughly 3 inches of snow was above the top of the chute. Therefore, I couldn't do it in one pass, so to speak. So some of the snow didn't get into the chute, got shoved off to one side, and I had to go back multiple times. Was the depth of the snow appropriate for the height of the chute on the front end of your electric snowblower? And how often did you have to recharge the battery on that? WS2N, K2RIW.
It's electric with, I plug it in. Lots of extension cords. Actually, I just used two long extension cords. Yeah. No, the height of it is only about, I guess about 14 inches. But the, I mean, when you get blizzards like this, you just push it, and then it kind of makes a cave underneath, you know, and then you just pull it back, everything falls down, and then you just push it again, and it just goes away, so no problem. You know, I could do 2 feet of snow. I mean, it takes longer than a gas-powered one, but the convenience of the, I'm just able to plug it in, just push the button and go. Don't fool with carburetors, don't fool with gas. The new ones, you really don't have much maintenance either, but you have no maintenance on this. Push the button and go. But I plug it in, Dick. It's made by Torpro.
N2RDB.
N2RDB recognized. Romeo Delta Bravo is what it sounds like. Tell us your name and correct me on your call letter, sir. Go ahead.
Call sign is correct. Romeo Delta Bravo. Name is Tim. Thank you, India Mike.
Volts. at 100 milliamps, and you try drawing 150 milliamps, and the voltage will drop down to zero. So right at that knee of the curve, my example, 12.5 volts at 100 milliamps, is where you're getting maximum energy out of the solar cell. So there's a very magic point where you get maximum energy out of the solar cell. Depending on the brightness of the sun that particular day and the way your solar panel is aimed, you get an entirely different curve if it's a cloudy day, if you know what I mean. They make some pretty fancy electronics. Let me drop. They make some pretty fancy electronics that does a dithering function, is what I call it. In other words, it makes a slight increase and decrease. It waggles around in current drain, senses the voltage, and therefore the circuit can find the knee of the curve for this particular solar exposure of this particular brand of solar cells today. And so they make some fancy electronics that finds the knee of the curve. It adjusts the loading to give you maximum energy output. That in turn goes into a switching regulator, which then after proper voltage adjustment charges your batteries or does whatever you want to do. So you don't want a dumb circuit. If you set up a dumb circuit, that in my example, where on a good day, it can produce maximum current of 150 milliamps, but the voltage drops down to zero, very little energy. And so at the best energy point, you might get 12 volts output at 100 milliamps. And so if you just simply set up your loading for 12 volts and 100 milliamps, you think, hey, I've adjusted it just right. Well, tomorrow is a slightly cloudy day, and your particular solar cells can only produce 11.5 volts at 80 milliamps at the knee of the curve of maximum energy output. And if you've adjusted your circuit to draw 100 milliamps, the voltage drops down to zero, and you've got very little energy. So as you can tell, the circuit has to be dynamic. Now, solar cells run, I don't know the exact number, let me drop. I think the solar cells you and I can buy without spending a whole lot of money are probably running numbers like 10 or 15% efficiency. As such, of all the solar energy hitting your solar cells, 85% of that energy is just turning into heat, not doing anything. 15% of it is coming out as electrical energy. And if you've got the circuit adjusted just right, you're sucking up the 15% of energy and it's charging your batteries. Now you put a dead short circuit across that solar cell. Instead of that 15% of energy going out to your circuit, it's now being reflected back to the solar cells. So the solar cells are going to get 15% of extra heat. I think with rare exception, that is not a damaging phenomenon. I think most solar cells will tolerate a dead short circuit because it's only 15% extra heating in my example. But they're a fun thing to play with. The fact that you get the energy free of charge is really fun. I'm going to have Paul tell us once again what's the total solar output on the International Space Station. I vaguely remember he told us 80 kilowatts. Is that true, Paul? What's the total output on a good day when all of the solar cells are cranking correctly? Is it something like 80 kilowatts? They've got almost an acre of solar cells up there. WS2N for that question, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, the loud number is 84, and I'm getting noise out of my speaker. And the high number is 125, so somewhere in between. And, you know, that's what they hope for all the time. Enough to light up 40 homes. If you put 40 homes in space, that's what it would be. That's the common number that they give you. And it's roughly about 30% efficiency with the gallium arsenide cells. And I know on Earth we don't have that. The newer ones are up to 40%, like the one on Juno, the one that's going to Jupiter this summer. Back to you, Dick.
In the case of NASA, you can almost say that price is not the problem. Therefore, they're using the very expensive solar cells and getting numbers like 30% efficiency. I think 5 years ago, you and I walk into a store that sells solar cells and we buy them, and we're not paying top dollar. I think we're getting something closer to 15% in the old days. Is that roughly true, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Yeah, that's what I've heard. Even now, we buy them at 15%. I mean, I don't know what, I don't even know what they're made of. If you were to buy one, Harbor Freight has them. You can buy two panels for $140, hook up a, you know, hook up your own voltage regulator to it. But, yeah, I don't know what to rate it at. I'd be happy with 15%, I guess. Gallium arsenide is what they use in NASA, everybody. You know, pretty much everything in space is gallium arsenide, no matter what it is. ESA uses them. We use back to them.
Thank you, Paul. Good information. But to explain a little bit more about how this fancy circuit, this dithering circuit is what I call it, to find the loading for maximum energy output of your solar cells, it's a little bit like a sight-impaired person who wants to walk up a smooth hill. If a sight-impaired person first walks to the left, then walks to the right, then walks forward, and then walks backward, and senses the tilt of his feet, he will very rapidly find out which direction is uphill, as long as it's a relatively smooth hill, without some funny bumps in it. By the same token, if you and I make a circuit that goes a little bit heavier in loading, a little bit lighter in loading, and it recognizes the voltage that occurs at the lighter loading and the heavier loading, and it instantaneously calculates energy. It's taking the voltage and the current at each one of those set points and calculating the energy. So like a blind man, it can find the loading that gives maximum energy output, so you get the fastest charging of your batteries, as long as you've got the right kind of a switching regulator that can now take that crazy voltage and convert it to the voltage and current that best does the charging of your particular NiCads or nickel metal hydrides or lithium iron batteries or whatever. So with a little bit of smarts, you and I could generate a circuit. We could design a circuit that will find the maximum energy output of this particular set of solar cells on this particular day with this amount of sun exposure of this particular day. KC2WGB, K2IW, the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Now, I don't think that would be too difficult. If you set up your solar panel and then took one solar panel and used that for the reference, as that changes due to clouds or whatever, you could bias a DC light to change the voltage, and it should do very well, and that should be very simple to do.
You said bias a DC supply. I'm confused. Rarely do you hook up a power supply to a set of solar cells. You'll set up a switching regulator connected to it, yes. But you don't pour energy into solar cells. You take energy out of them. So I'm a little confused by the wording there, Paul. Hi, John. Over to you, John. K2IW.
Yeah, we would be using a regulator circuit to control that voltage that's being used from the cell itself going to the load, and we could put a circuit in there that as the sun value changes, that radiant energy changes, it would change the bias on the control circuit and maintain the voltage, and as long as we're near the knee, we should be pretty efficient.
You said maintain the voltage. I'm confused again. The ideal voltage and the ideal current both change depending on the state of the solar cells, the amount of sunlight, and how cloudy it is and whatever. And the solar cells are supplying a source of current/voltage. So all you have to do is present the right resistance.